Now we can see a new world coming into view. A world in which there is the very real prospect of a new world order.
The new world order does not mean surrendering our national sovereignty or forfeiting our interests.
Left you, this final comment was made. A Chicago Tribune article by John Margolis, dated September 30th, 1994, said that the global biodiversity assessment was a process that had just begun and that no document existed. A participant in the GBA process had secretly photocopied several hundred pages of the peer review draft of the document. Summaries of the draft documents were prepared and provided to every member of the U.S. Senate. The shocking details of the bizarre plan to transform societies was sufficient to block a ratification vote in the closing days of the 103rd Congress, despite the fact that the treaty had been approved by the Foreign Relations Committee by a vote of 16-3. What treaty are they speaking of? Agenda 21. Which called for each nation to create a plan for sustainable development consistent with the principles of the Rio Declaration. The UN created a new Commission on Sustainable Development, and Maurice Strong created a new NGO called Earth Council, based in Costa Rica, to coordinate NGO activity to implement the Rio Declaration principles through national sustainable development programs. Earth Council has produced a directory listing more than 100 nations that have formal sustainable development plans under development. The United Nations created another program to empower children to help implement the sustainable development program entitled Rescue Mission Planet Earth. In a Rescue Mission newsletter action update, their work is described as getting governments together, quote, who try to make the others feel guilty for not having done what they promised on Agenda 21. Good day, Mr. and Mrs. America, and welcome to our fourth and final installment in our series, From Here to Eternity. I'm your host for the series, Jeffrey Bennett. To implement Agenda 21 and the principles of the Rio Declaration in America, then-President Bill Clinton issued Executive Order No. 12852, dated June 29th of 1993, which created the President's Council on Sustainable Development, or PCS. Jonathan Lash, president of the World Resources Institute, was named as co-chair. J.D. Hare, president of the IUCN and former president of the National Wildlife Federation, was one of eight NGO leaders appointed to the council. 11 government officials, along with the eight NGO leaders, easily dominated the discussions and produced a predictable report from the 28-member council. And not surprisingly, the final report, Sustainable America, A New Consensus, presented 154 action items to achieve 38 specific recommendations, which are precisely the recommendations called for in Agenda 21. The most casual reading of the PCS's 16 We Believe statements, compared with the 27 principles of the Rio Declaration, revealed that the PCS had simply Americanized the Rio language to form the foundation for implementing the United Nations agenda in America. PCS belief number 10, for example, entitled Economic Growth, Environmental Protection, and Social Equity, all of which are linked. We need to develop integrated policies to achieve these national goals. It sounds very much like Rio Principle number 3, which stated the right to development must be fulfilled so as to equitably meet developmental and environmental needs of present and future generations. The PCS is Agenda 21 at work in America. The PCS also provided a glimpse of the global governance process to come. Public policy was initiated by non-elected officials, massaged into specific proposals by an NGO-dominated stakeholders council, written into regulations administratively by willing bureau rats who themselves are frequently former NGO officials, or, in fact, presented to Congress for approval, along with the threat of retaliation at the ballot box from the millions of NGO members represented by the Stakeholders Council. Now, the UNCED, and Agenda 21 covered an extremely wide range of issues that affected virtually every person on the planet. The purpose for the array of policy recommendations put forth for public consumption is ostensibly to protect the planet from inevitable destruction at the hands of greedy, uncaring, or unaware humans. At the core, however, the policies recommended are socialist policies, built on the assumption that government is sovereign and must manage the affairs of its citizens. Government manage the affairs of its citizens? It's never worked so far. But you see nothing in Agenda 21, the Rio Declaration, or the PCS recommendations even acknowledges the idea that humans are born free and are sovereign over the governments they create. Nothing acknowledges the idea that government's first responsibility is to protect the inherent freedom of its citizens, particularly the freedom to own and use property. To the contrary, everything about the UNCED documents aims to limit human freedom and to restrict the use of private property until it can be placed in the public domain. And as sweeping as the UNCED documents are, they are but the first step in the final march to global governance, my friends. The IUCN then held its triennial session in Buenos Aires, Argentina, 1993. Dr. J.D. Hare assumed presidency of the organization, as Shirdath Ramphal stepped down to devote more time to his position as co-chair of the UN-funded Commission on Global Governance. His parting message was quite illuminating. Rio, for all its disappointments, set the seal on a new agenda for the world, the agenda of sustainable development. It was not, of course, new for IUCN, which had blazed a trail for sustainable development since 1980, with the World Conservation Strategy. In the final analysis, it is a matter of equity. There are also other aspects to the claims of equity. If there are limits to the use of some resources, they must be fairly shared. Early users who have prospered must not preempt them, but must begin to use less, so that others may also progress. The rich must moderate their demands on the resources so that the poor may raise theirs to levels that allow them a decent standard of living. Equity calls for no less. We need to persuade others that for the earth's sake, consumption must be better balanced between rich and poor. Well, equity or wealth redistribution is clearly the underlying purpose for sustainable development, my friends, in the IUCN agenda. Its influence over UNEP activities and upon the global agenda cannot be overstated. Its membership includes 68 sovereign nations, 103 government agencies, and more than 640 NGOs. And among the government agencies listed as contributors in the 1993 annual report are the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You see, the U.S. State Department at that time contributed more than $1 million per year to the IUCN. I almost hesitate to want to know what we're funding that thing for today. Now, the IUCN evaluates every proposed World Heritage Site and recommends to UNESCO whether or not it should be listed or listed, quote, in danger, end quote. George Frampton, Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, then asked UNESCO specifically to send a representative from IUCN to evaluate Yellowstone Park as a site in danger in 1995. On January 18th of 96, then-President Clinton issued Executive Order 12986, which stated, I hereby extend to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources the privileges and immunities that provide or pertain to immunity from suit. The IUCN is the driving force between UNEP and the global environmental agenda. The Convention on Biological Diversity was developed and proposed by the IUCN in 1981 to the World Commission on Environment and Development. The IUCN is the architect and engineer designing the road, my friends, to global governance.
Your eyes refuse to meet with mine. They glance away in fear, as if you should not look at your reflection in the mirror. How can I explain to you when you won't understand? You scoff me and you mock me and reject the truth at hand. You spread your vicious rumors all across this troubled land. You willfully and knowingly transgress from his command. Your mind has been made up to you by...
Now, during the year 1993, we will move across the map, the global map, as it were, from Rio to Vienna, Rio de Janeiro to Vienna, Austria. The UN Conference on Human Rights was held in Vienna in June of 93. The primary objective of that conference was to promote the pending convention on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women. Well, few Americans have ever heard of such a treaty and would probably not object on the basis of the title alone. But however, as is always the case, the devil is in the details. The treaty would guarantee the right to housing for women, the right to choice or abortion. That's Article 16E. Cecilia Acevedo Reyes, president of the National Institute of Womanhood, in testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, stated thus: "This convention is deeply flawed. It will, in fact, harm women, men, and children by establishing an international policy instrument that can be used as a weapon against the family, the institution of marriage, and the cultural and religious values, and that can be turned into a tool for the societal control of women," end quote. Well, while the convention aimed at guaranteeing certain so-called rights to women, it would in fact give to the United Nations the power to enforce those rights. Instead of empowering women, it would in fact empower the state, the global state, the United Nations. But the convention at that point had been ratified by 130 nations, not by the United States. And yet the Clinton administration continued to prod the State Department officials to urge Senate ratification. And now it's 94. We move from Vienna to Uruguay. April 15th, the New York Times then carried a full-page ad that hailed the World Trade Organization as the third pillar of the New World Order. The World Trade Organization, or WTO, sailed through the Senate in the closing days of the 103rd Congress, handing over to the United Nations system the authority and the mechanism to impose and enforce its agenda upon America. The WTO charter required the optimal use of the world resources in accordance with the objective of sustainable development. That was in the preamble. It required the World Trade Organization to make appropriate arrangement for effective cooperation with NGOs and intergovernmental organizations. It required member nations to change their laws to conform to the WTO. Each member shall ensure the conformity of its laws, regulations, and administrative procedures with its obligations as provided in the annexed agreements. And although the U.S. would have had to pay disproportionate share of the World Trade Organization and cost, it only had one vote and no veto. World Trade Organization may impose trade sanctions on a nation that it determined is not in compliance with any international treaty. It may impose sanctions, fines, and penalties on a nation or on an industry. Members are bound by the dispute resolutions dictated by the World Trade Organization. Bilateral trade deals must meet the approval of the WTO. Bilateral or multilateral trade agreements can be changed by a vote of the members of the WTO. Article 16 says no reservations may be made in respect to any provision of the agreement. That means that no matter what the provisions are, no one could object to them. Now, the World Trade Organization could not have survived without the United States. The United Nations could not have controlled world trade without the World Trade Organization. But now the facility is in place, and the bureaucracy is gearing up to become the first line enforcement mechanism of global governance, my friends. 94, from Uruguay to Cairo, we move on around the globe once again. Population control had long been a high priority for the United Nations. and though promoted for different reasons, by different names at different times, currently the population explosion is cited as the underlying cause of the human impact on biodiversity and on climate change. Population control entered the United Nations agenda as a eugenics issue by virtue of Julian Huxley's involvement with British Population Investigation Commission and the Eugenics Society. Now remember, in 1954, the Rome Conference promoted the concept of fertility as an economic factor. By 1974, the Bucharest Conference integrated population and development issues with the developed nations, insisting that population reduction was essential to economic development. And when the issue emerged at the Mexico City Conference, it appeared as a matter of women's rights and freedom of choice. In Cairo at the September International Conference, also in 94, the Conference on Population and Development, population control was seen by some to be a matter of women's empowerment by the state, while others saw population control as an essential requirement of sustainable development initiatives. The Cairo Program of Action stated thusly, "Unsustainable consumption and production patterns are contributing to the unsustainable use of natural resources and environmental degradation, as well as to social inequities and poverty. And governments should establish the requisite internal institutional mechanisms to ensure that population factors are appropriately addressed within the decision-making and administrative process." Now, the conference agenda then focused on gender equality, the eradication of poverty, family in its various forms, children's rights and education, as well as population policies, human rights, sustainable development. But population control is critical to the overall global environmental agenda. The Global Biodiversity Assessment concluded that, quote, "a reasonable estimate for an industrialized world society at the present North American material standard of living would be 1 billion. At the more frugal European standard of living, 1 to 3 billion would be possible. An agricultural world in which most human beings are peasants should be able to support 5 to 7 billion people." End of quote. The cost of the various UN population programs discussed at the conference at that time was estimated between $17 and $75 billion, certainly less money than we've committed to our war on Iraq. The war on terror. The World Resources Institute reported in the NGO Networker that Zero Population Group was the NGO coordinating lobbying activities for the Cairo Conference. From 1995, we moved from Cairo to Copenhagen. In Copenhagen, the UN's World Summit on Social Development was the occasion for advancing the road to global governance. The central theme of that conference was the eradication of poverty. The agenda also included population policies, the reduction of consumption, and elevating NGO participation. More than anything else, the conference was about money. Getting it to the UN and increasing the power of the UN to collect it and spend it. The conference proposed an international 2020 compact, which would require developing countries and aid donors to allocate 20% official development assistance, or OAD, to human development priorities. Commitment 8 in the draft conference document called on nations to target 0.07% of gross domestic product to official development assistance. Well, the conference was used by the UN-funded Commission on Global Governance to float a trial balloon, global taxation. Buried in the UNDP's 1994 Human Development Report was an idea advanced by James Tobin, calling for a uniform international tax on international currency transactions. And when the UNDP report was presented to the conference, it was heralded as the way to provide substantial, reliable funds for sustainable human development. Conference documents described the proceeds from the tax as immense, over $1.5 trillion a year. That's 150 times the current total United Nations budget. All to be devoted to international and humanitarian purposes and to be placed at the disposal of international institutions. Other global taxes were also proposed on international travel, telecommunications, taxes on resource use, especially energy resources. Paragraph 75 of the conference document called for the strengthening of non-government organizations, enabling them to, that's NGOs once again, enabling them to participate actively in policy making, involving these organizations in the design, implementation, the evaluation of social development strategies and specific programs. But it was clear to Rita Joseph, who attended the Conference for Population Research Institute, that, quote, the thrust currently behind the latest declarations is to set up not only monitoring bodies, but enforcement agencies to which individual and group petitions concerning perceived grievances may be mounted. There is a push on to expand international government so that it reaches right down to communities and homes, there to dabble in values reorientation. End quote. Values reorientation. They're going to reorient us as to what our values are supposed to be. Can you accept that? Will you accept that? NGO lobbying activities for that conference were coordinated by the Overseas Development Council in Washington, D.C., according to WRI's NGO Networker. By the way, the editor of the NGO Networker, Sarah Burns, went to work for the UNDP in Washington as NGO liaison in 1994. And from Copenhagen, we moved to New York in 1995, where the UN Commission on Sustainable Development held its third meeting in New York. This was a commission meeting rather than a world conference. The pomp was not as pompous, but the circumstance was as significant as any UN meeting. The agenda focused on land degradation, desertification, desertification, forests, biodiversity, patterns of consumption, financial resources, technology transfer. The commission is said to be developing a new international convention on sustainable development, but a new strategy is being used. You see, other conventions have been developed through a long series of commission meetings until they are complete. Then they are presented to the world at a world conference, as was the case with the Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Convention on Biological Diversity. Maurice Strong's strategy, however, is to get individual nations to develop their own sustainable development plan, all of which are developed within the framework of, you got it, Agenda 21, so that when the Convention on Sustainable Development is finally completed, most of the nations will already be doing what the convention calls for. Kind of makes each nation think they're doing it on their own, doesn't it? But until the convention is complete and ratified, the sustainable development programs within individual nations will be authorized by national law. But when the convention is ratified, the programs will then come under the authority and under the regulatory and enforcement procedures of the United Nations. We now move to Beijing from New York. Also in 95, all the pomp that was missing in New York was present in Beijing for the 4th World Women's Conference in September 1995, preceded by a week-long NGO forum. The event was expected to produce a platform for action to guide national and international policy on women's issues well into the 21st century. The event was the culmination of a 180-day local-to-global-to-local women's empowerment campaign organized by the NGO WIDO, Women for Environment and Development Organization. You see how everything comes under environment, environment, environment. This is where they go after the little fuzzy bears and the little cute squirrels and the chipmunks and, ooh, the little fish and the little endangered worms. They go for the environment because everybody wants clean air, everybody wants clean water, and this is what they're using to go for the gold. Now, WIDO's parent organization, Women USA Fund, Inc., was headed then by Bella Abzug, Congressman or then Congresswoman Patsy Mink, Maxine Waters, Gloria Steinem. Funding for the NGO came from the Ford Foundation, MacArthur Foundation, there's the MacArthur Foundation again, the Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation, and the Turner Foundation. Yes, that Turner, Mr. Ted. The campaign featured the coordinated release of press kits to the media, boycotts, take over the legislature for a day rallies, forums, lunchtime workshops with fellow workers, and a myriad of actions all over the world. The purpose of the campaign was to focus public attention on the Beijing conference and more particularly on WIDO's conference agenda. You remember who was there? She wants to be your president, folks. WIDO called for the tracking of all national and international economic and development programs by social and gender impact studies, restrictions on economic growth in industrialized countries, the transfer of common property, in other words, water, forests, grazing lands, fishing waters. Hey, let's reintroduce the Mexican gray wolf into the grazing lands. We'll take care of that. And we want to turn it all over to international control. prohibiting ownership of such common property to national or international corporations. They want national and international strategies to alleviate women's poverty, remuneration for women's unpaid work, housekeeping, child rearing, etc. Wait a minute, that ain't biblical, that's part of the deal. How about taxes shifting from income to consumption, universal guaranteed income and payment for child care and other socially productive activities? And a universal 50-50 program that would require all businesses and government entities to have a 50-50 men and women workforce. My friends, this is diabolical, if nothing else. But the conference produced more hype, hoopla, and hyperbole than anything else. First, there was a flap about having a world conference on women's issues in a nation which so severely oppressed women. Then there was the flap about the facilities. Then there was a flap about the extreme security measures. Then there was Hillary Clinton, who put in a personal appearance. Then First Lady, of course. Of significance is the reappearance of the Tobin tax as a recommended way to fund the extravagant programs demanded by the delegates. There reappeared new calls to elevate the status and authority of NGOs in decision-making and in program administration. And there was a new idea advanced. The FDR. No, not the Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The FDR meant family dependency ratio. Now, this idea called for extensive monitoring of the activities, the consumption and production of every member of every family to determine whether a family is a net consumer or a producer. Now, this idea grew out of Guido's demand to value and remunerate women for their unpaid work. Hey, where's mine? Huh? I do this. I don't get paid. Yeah, that's my Rodney Dangerfield imitation. You know, I ain't got no respect. You think I make a lot of money doing this? Forget it. Throughout the conference, debate on the serious issues as well as the frivolous issues proceeded with virtually no change. No challenge to the appropriateness of UN jurisdiction over a range of issues that should be at least national, if not extremely personal. Taxation, employment policies, and land use policies were all offered up to the United Nations. Delegates and the NGO lobbyists passed the stage of questioning the appropriateness of global governance. It's now a question of how much and how soon. There's no longer any discussion of freedom or property rights or national sovereignty. The discussion centers around how best to get the wealth from developed countries into the United Nations for redistribution to the underdeveloped countries, also under the control of the United Nations. The documents coming from each of the successive world conferences continue to reflect the assumption that government, the United Nations government, should be sovereign, and that nation states are secondary, and individuals our cannon fodder. My friends, there's much to think about. We'll be back in a moment as we move from Beijing to San Francisco.
In the mountains up near Sandpoint, north of
Wrong song. Hey, it's live radio, my friends. We want this country back, and you ain't getting it, UN.
Had this crazy dream about some folks who love this country, who all began to dream the same dream. And when the morning came, there arose across this nation people thinking one and the same. And they awoke to find their freedoms and all their liberties had gradually been taken away. And when they realized the danger to their posterity, I heard those patriotic people say, we want this country back. We ain't just joking, Jack. We want our liberty and our dignity and our freedoms and our rights restored. We want this country back. She's been driven way off track. We're wide awake and we're madder than hell now. And we ain't gonna take it anymore. No, we're not gonna take it anymore.
Remember
golden days when the stars and stripes forever symbolize.
The Beijing conference had hardly adjourned when Gorbachev's State of the World Forum convened in San Francisco, September 27th of 1995. Though not an official UN function, the forum was designed to advance global governance. Forum president and founder of the Christic Institute, Jim Garrison, told the San Francisco Weekly, "We are going to end up with world government. We have to govern and regulate human interaction." Gorbachev told the hand-picked audience of celebrities and dignitaries that, quote, "We are giving birth to the first global civilization," end quote. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, told the audience that regionalism must precede world government. New Age guru Sam Keen received enthusiastic applause for his pronouncement, "If we cut the world's population by 90%, there won't be enough people left to do ecological damage." If we cut the world's population by 90, that's not 9, that's 90%, there won't be enough people left to do ecological damage. And the audience applauded. The forum's agenda called for the transfer of all armaments to the United Nations, the initiation of global taxation, stricter population control programs, and the elimination of nationalism and national borders. The highlight of the event was a joint presentation by Gorbachev and Daddy Bush and former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Gorbachev, of course, is the founding president of Green Cross and the Gorbachev Foundation. He, along with Maurice Strong, were regarded as candidates to replace Boutros-Ghali as Secretary General of the United Nations at the expiration of Ghali's term in December of 96. Well, we know who got the job. Because the UN rules have required that an African hold the position of Secretary General for another term, Kofi Annan assumed that position. Strong had been designated his senior advisor for restructuring the United Nations. And on 16 July of 1997, Kofi Annan released a report on UN reform plans. They coincided with the blueprint drawn in our Global Neighborhood Report of the Commission on Global Governance. By the way, it's noteworthy that its lead author is none other than Maurice Strong. And now in 1996, we leave San Francisco and move on to Istanbul. Habitat 2, UN Conference on Human Settlements, convened in Istanbul in June of 96. And despite the fact that Habitat 1 called for the elimination of private property by 1976, the United States had contributed more than $32 million to its operations and sent an enthusiastic delegation to Istanbul to assure the conference that America is supporting its objectives. The entire agenda was bathed in the ambiguous language of sustainable development, and two of the major issues to emerge through the noise of 4,000 delegates and 25,000 NGO representatives were, first, the right to housing, and secondly, the good governance. Something really bothers me here. 4,000 delegates from different nations around the world were sent to this conference. And yet we had over 6 times as many representatives from non-governmental organizations. Who's zooming who with this business, folks? Who stands to benefit? Follow the money trail. Follow the path of power. Now, at least 3 previous UN documents declared the right to housing. 2 of them have not been ratified by the U.S. Consequently, the universal right to housing was in question. Article 5 of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination declared a right to housing. Well, the U.S. has ratified that convention. The International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Human Rights and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, both of which declared the right to housing, have not been ratified by this nation. And as the leader of one NGO called the Centre, C-E-N-T-R-E, you know, the limey spelling for the word center, the Centre on Housing Rights and Evictions says, quote, "The right to housing is a powerful mobilizing tool for women's groups, street children, and so on. Denying this right would be a great step backwards." Well, if housing is declared to be a universal right, then the United Nations would have the responsibility of guaranteeing and enforcing that right, and to have meaning, The United Nations would have to have the authority to collect the money necessary to provide universal housing, my friends. Of more direct importance is the issue of good governance. Throughout all the conferences of the 1990s, emphasis has been placed on expanding the role and functions of non-governmental organizations in the decision-making process and the management and administration of government programs at every level. Habitat II Director General Wally Indow said, "The road to Istanbul has been marked by many innovations. One of seminal importance has been a pioneering change in the rules of procedure, a change that was initiated during the preparatory process and subsequently endorsed by the General Assembly in recognition of the important role of local authorities and NGOs. And as a result, all the organizations and institutions of civil society will receive unparalleled recognition at a UN conference, dominating their representatives to participate in a formal session. They speak for countless millions of men and women in the cities and towns across the planet, the true constituents of Habitat II." End quote. This rule change officially elevated NGOs to participatory status in the policy-making process of the United Nations. Policy-making by individuals who have no direct or indirect accountability to the electorate is a foreign concept in America. It's common, in fact, expected in socialist countries. In America, if voters do not like the way America is being represented in the United Nations, well, voters can theoretically remove the president who appoints UN delegates and elects someone else who more accurately reflects our values. American voters cannot unelect representatives from the Sierra Club or the president of the gay feminist NGO or any other NGO who may be selected by their peers to make global policies which affect Americans. Moreover, Rule 61 invited participation by local officials. Heretofore, the UN has served its member nations as represented by official delegates. This rule is the first step toward bypassing the official national government to extend UN influence and programs and eventually money, regulations, and enforcement directly to the people within the nation. Not this nation. You see, that's the essence of governance by civil society, orchestrated by the United Nations. This is the first wave of the reality of global governance. And now in 96, we move from Istanbul to Geneva. The second meeting of the Conference of the Parties to the Framework Convention on Climate Change convened in Geneva, Switzerland, July 8th to the 19th of 1996. The treaty was presented in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit and has now been ratified by 159 nations, including the United States. The treaty requires participating Annex I, or developed nations, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels, and this was expected to be done by the year 2000. The time of this recording and this program, it's now 2003. Where do we stand? At COPI, however, meeting in Berlin in 1995, the Alliance of Small Island States, or AOSIS, proposed that developed nations reduce emissions to a level 20% less than 1990 levels. The COP did not adopt the proposal, but did adopt the Berlin Mandate, which was an agreement to develop a legally binding protocol by 1997. COPI II was designed to negotiate the terms of the protocol for adoption of COPI III in Kyoto, Japan, in 1997. To influence the proceedings, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its second assessment report, and for the first time, the official UN body claimed that, quote, "the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate," end quote. And although 100 scientists, some of whom were participants in the IPCC process, publicly objected to the report's findings in a statement called the Leipzig Declaration, the conference pushed forward toward a legally binding protocol. The conference document called the Ministerial Declaration endorsed the SAR, declares that emissions would eventually have to be reduced by 50%, and calls on developed nations to initiate policies to reduce emissions within specific industries: energy, transportation, agriculture, forestry, waste management, and economic instruments. We move now from Geneva to the global conference in 1998. When Srinath Ramphal handed over the IUCN gavel to Jay Hare in 1993, he turned his attention to the Commission on Global Governance, which he co-chaired along with Ingvar Carlsson, former minister of Sweden and then leader of the Social Democratic Party in Sweden. Like the commissions of the 1980s, Brandt and Palme, McBride and Brundtland, it was an independent commission, meaning that it was not created by a resolution of the UN General Assembly. It operated officially as an NGO, but as a practical matter, it was in fact an instrument of the UN. The Commission on Global Governance received the formal endorsement of Boutros-Ghali, UN Secretary General at that time, and funding from the UN Development Program. Nine nations and several private foundations also supplied funding. Oscar Arias, former president of Costa Rica, was a member of the commission. Now, Arias, if you remember, won the Nobel Peace Prize for his peace plan, which called on nations to direct disarmament savings to the UN's development programs. Adele Simons, or Simmons, president of the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and a member of the CFR, was a member. Mari Strong also served on the 28-member commission. This guy Strong sure gets around. Several of the commission's ideas were advanced experimentally at the various world conferences during the 90s. They tested the waters particularly for the several global taxation ideas and for their ideas about global governance through civil society. Their final report was released in conjunction with the 50th anniversary of the UN in the fall of 95, entitled Our Global Neighborhood, the Report of the Commission on Global Governance. The commission recommended thus: the General Assembly should agree to hold a World Conference on Governance in 1998 with its decisions to be ratified and put into effect by 2000. Hereafter, numbers in parentheses or will indicate the reference. We're not going to get into that. We don't need to. The commission based its recommendations on the belief that human activities have irreversible environmental impacts, and that human activities need to be managed to keep the adverse outcomes within prudent bounds. Effective and equitable management calls for a systemic, long-term, global approach guided by the principle of sustainable development. Its universal application is a priority among the tasks of global governance, end quote. The commission is also convinced that the world is ready to accept a, quote, set of core values that can unite people of all cultural, political, religious, or philosophical backgrounds. It is fundamentally important that governance should be underpinned by democracy at all levels and ultimately by the rule of enforceable law. Underpinned by democracy has a totally different meaning to people who live in a socialist democratic nation than to people who live in a so-called free country such as America. You see, Americans think of democracy as a process by which they elect the individuals to represent them in their exercise of the limited power that Americans seem to think that they have chosen to give to their government. In socialist nations, democracy means participating in the process by which the sovereign government decides how to manage its subjects. Oops, sounds like us. The core values upon which global governance is to be based include liberty. But again, in America, liberty has a totally different meaning from what the commission describes. They describe it thusly: liberty is threatened by deprivation, economic dislocation, oppression based on gender or sexual orientation, abuse of children, debt, bondage, and other social and economic patterns, end quote. Well, you and I realize that these conditions are only some of the inherent risks of being free. Liberty, you see, is the freedom to exercise individual ingenuity and apply individual energy to avoid the risks and rise above all other dangers. The very fact that Americans and others who live in free societies have risen above these risks creates an injustice in the world, according to the commission. And although people are born into widely unequal economic and social circumstances, the commission goes on, great disparities in their conditions or life chances are an affront to the human sense of justice. A concern for equity is not tantamount to an insistence on equality, but it does call for deliberate efforts to reduce gross inequalities and to promote a fairer share of resources. All of this certainly sounds like the Communist Manifesto in so many respects. Mutual respect, which is defined to be tolerance, by the way, caring within a global reach, and integrity, which is defined as supporting the program, all of these things round out the Commission's so-called core values. Voluntary acceptance of global governance is the preferred means of achieving it. Education programs to teach the global ethic have been underway by UNESCO and by UNEP for over two decades. and that the United States government, through its representatives to the various UN agencies, has not already crushed. This global governance agenda is a testament to the effectiveness of the UN's education program, and, in effect, it's a testament to the ineffectiveness of our education system. But the Commission is not content to rely upon voluntary acceptance. An intricate maze of international enforceable law is encircling the planet in the form of conventions and treaties and executive agreements. To implement, administer, and enforce global governance, my friends, the Commission has recommended a major structuring of the United Nations system. The Commission recommends an assembly of the people, which should consist of representatives of organizations accredited to the General Assembly as civil society organizations, a forum of 300 to 600 organs of global civil society would be desirable and practicable. A new petitions council has been recommended to consist of 5 to 7 representatives of civil society for the purpose of reviewing petitions from NGOs in the field to direct to the appropriate UN agency for enforcement action. A new Economic Security Council would replace the existing Economic and Social Council. The new ESC would consist of no more than 23 members who would have responsibility for all international financial and development activities. The IMF, the World Bank, World Trade Organization, virtually all finance and development activities would be under the authority of that body. There would be no veto power by any nation, nor would there be permanent member status for any nation. The existing Security Council would be restructured. Veto power of the 5 permanent members would be eliminated, as would permanent member status over time. And with the Secretary General's office expanded to include the function of Commander-in-Chief, the Security Council would oversee a new UN standing army, complete with support and transport car capabilities. The Commission calls for an international convention on curtailment of the arms trade, a demilitarization of international society, and the disarming of citizens. A new international criminal court has been created, complete with its own independent prosecutor, a panel of prosecutors of the highest moral character. The International Court of Justice has become compulsory, and it will issue binding verdicts in order to strengthen international law. Binding verdicts, that means no appeal. To protect the environment, their charter states, we propose that the trusteeship council be given the mandate of exercising trusteeship over the global commons. The global commons include the atmosphere, outer space, the oceans beyond national jurisdiction, and the related environment and life support systems that contribute to the support of human life. Its functions would include the administration of environmental treaties in such fields as climate change, biodiversity, outer space, law of the sea. It would refer as appropriate any economic or security issues arising from these matters to the Economic Security Council or the Security Council itself. The Commission, you see, suggests that this new council would benefit from contributions from civil society organizations. And of major significance is the expansion of the concept of security. And it states thusly, all people, no less than all states, have a right to a secure existence. And all states have an obligation to protect those rights. Where people are subjected to massive suffering and distress, however, there is a need to weigh a state's right to autonomy against its people's right to security. We believe a global consensus exists today for a UN response on humanitarian grounds in cases of gross abuse of the security of people. The security of the people is challenged from threats to the Earth's life support systems, extreme economic deprivation, and proliferation of conventional small arms, the terrorizing of civilian populations by domestic factions and gross violations of human rights, end of quote. The Commission, my friends, believes that the United Nations should protect the security of all people inside the borders of sovereign nations, with or without the invitation of the national government. And it calls for a world conference in to present the treaties and other documents necessary to bring about complete global governance. Stick around, and we'll be back with some closing comments.
It's all been changed, and when we gaze upon the glory, it's hard to fight back feelings of shame. We're fed up with lying politicians and greedy corporations who have sold us out time and again. And we're sick and tired of sending our soldiers off to wars that we were never meant to win. We want this country back. We ain't just joking, Jack. We want our liberty and our dignity and our freedoms and our rights restored. We want this country back. She's been driven way off track. We're wide awake and we're madder than hell now, and we ain't gonna take it anymore. No, we're not gonna take it anymore. Now we know our cause is right and our victory's on the way, and we won't give up the fight till we hear 200 million say we want this country back. We ain't just joking, Jack. We want our liberty and our dignity and our freedoms and our rights restored. We want this country back, and we ain't taking any more flack. We're wide awake and we're madder than hell now, and we ain't gonna take it anymore.
I wonder, the words to Carl's song, "We're not going to take it anymore," is that in fact true? Or are we going to take the knowledge that we hope we've gained out of this four-hour series, From Here to Eternity, The Rise of Global Governance? One of our longtime listeners and supporters, Tim Rivera, has been trying to get me to discuss this Agenda 21 for a long, long time, and I have a long way to go. I certainly don't have the knowledge level that Tim has, but this is a beginning. I see the United Nations using this entire issue, this environmental issue, to gain control. We open this fourth episode today with those infamous words of Daddy Bush talking about the New World Order as we prepared to embark in Gulf War Part 1. We went through 8 years of Clinton, who had amongst the worst foreign policy of any president that I can think of. And then we had Junior. George Walker Bush, G.W., Junior, Shrub, Sonny Boy, whatever you want to call him. And that offends you when I talk that way, because that is being demeaning to the president. It's not being demeaning to the presidency. It may be demeaning to the individual who's holding office. I didn't vote for him, but then I didn't vote for Al Gore either. And as we complete this series now, it makes us begin to wonder, what do the next 4 years bring us? What do the next 8 years? Do we have 8 years left, or 12, or 20? And how will you be held accountable for your actions, or more importantly, your inactions, my friends? All these things are problematic as I see it. The name of this four-hour series you've been listening to, From Here to Eternity, The Rise of Global Governance. I hope that you begin to understand that it's the United Nations that truly is behind all of this. And who is behind the United Nations? We've named a lot of names. We've named a lot of players. I hope you found some benefit in this series. For those of you who've listened to our program, Perspectives on America, for so many years, who have taken advantage of some of our previous series, All the King's Men, The True Story of the Market Crash at 29, Rich Man, Poor Man, which named even greater names and spent more time talking about the history of the Rothschilds and their founding and those who were involved with the Club of Rome and the CFR and the Trilaterals, etc., etc. Some of our other series are, now we're up to five or six or seven part series as we shine a spotlight on Israel and their position in this entire global governance situation, and how they seem to crack a whip and we jump to the tune of billions upon billions of dollars each and every year. So many of these series that we've done, we've tried to bring history and accuracy to the airwaves, and we hope you'll take advantage of this series. It is available in its entirety, all four parts, in four compact discs for $29.95. To get it, you may call us at area code 623-327-1778. That is area code 623-327-1778. You may send us a check, money order, cash all wrapped up in tin foil if you care to do so. You may give us a call, once again, 623-327-1778. Get your reservation in. Product is being reproduced as we conclude this series today. I'll be glad to take your MasterCard, your Visa, or your American Express if you wish to order it in that fashion. Take advantage. I hope that we've been able to share something of value for each and every one of you. In several of the segments of this program, we played the music of Gary McFarlane from an award-winning 1968 album called America the Beautiful, on account of its disappearance. And of course, his entire statement was environmentally related. Don't misunderstand, for those of you who may be hearing this for the first time, either on the air or maybe some years down the road, I'm not against environmental issues. I'm against the radicalism that now has taken over this nation. Our closing piece of music from Gary McFarlane's America the Beautiful, it's called Last Rites for the Promised Land. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett.
Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store.
President Gasson, may God bless and keep you as he watches over this nation.
John, I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee that's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today because you can handle the truth.